the show.
Well, hey everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of The Boundless Show, which apparently is themed around physicality. I'm just going to throw it out there and make everyone uncomfortable from the get-go. But no, good times. Actually, in our Q&A near the end, we have a listener who wrote in and is fantasizing about married sex and is wondering if that is okay. So one of our counselors is going to come in and address that. And then we have author and psychologist and counselor Dan Allender, Dr. Dan Allender, in the studio with us to really, he talks a lot about intimacy, and obviously he's known for his book Intimate Allies, as well as The Healing Path, a number of other books that he's co-written or written solo, but really a guy who's been known for years now in the world of marriage and relationships, specifically as they relate to a number of different intimacy issues. So we're going to hear from him in the culture segment. So we thought we would kick it off by something a little bit lighter, but still hopefully with some takeaway value. And that is the topic of hugging. Oh, hugging. Doesn't everyone just love
Reminds
hugs?
Reminds me of Care Bears or something.
Come here, Lisa. Let me give you a hug.
Exactly. And whether or not your experience with hugs has involved, you know, repression or aversion, or you just love to hug people, you don't care who you're hugging, this is going to be interesting because we're going to get everyone's perspectives on this. So at the table, we have our own Nathan Pyle. Hey, Nathan.
Hello.
Great to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
Today. Yeah, this will be fun. And a new face at the table, though you can't see his face. Brian Krause. Great to have you, Brian.
Hey, Lisa. It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Sometimes I call him BK. People know
that
people
works
call
too.
Him BK around here. So sometimes I do that. And then Martha, of course, here at the table. So
rounding things out.
She's just ready to hug everyone right now. I can just see it in her.
She hugged us when we sat down individually.
Thanks
and
for
she'll hug you when you leave again, too. It's good. It's
no, just, people who really know thing. Me. Would know that is not true at all.
That's true. That was being facetious. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the whole idea of hugs, because there are a number of different things related to hugs that we can address. And we were talking a little bit about this before we went on tape. And it basically the, you know, are you okay with hugs? Are you not okay with hugs? And then there are a number of different dynamics involving hugs. So when you, if someone were to ask you, are you a hugger? What would you say?
I'll receive hugs. I don't very often initiate them.
Okay. Okay. Kind is that because you think men should be the initiators? So you, what does that mean with other women? Who's going to initiate?
Well, it's true with anyone. Because I think, like, especially with my family, it seems like we mostly hug when we are saying hello or goodbye. Mm-hmm. Like, if you have been states apart for months. Mm-hmm. So it's not, like, an everyday kind of thing.
Do you feel like you really want to hug them? Or do you just feel it's kind of like the thing you probably should do?
A little bit of both.
Okay. Yeah. It's kind of just expected a little bit.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's like that with my family. Mm-hmm. What about you guys?
I'm a hugger. I'm kind of known for popping the personal bubble.
Okay.
But well, for most times it's for someone that I've known for a while and you know, maybe in a small group with. And definitely as a married guy, definitely I'll hug other people if my wife's around. Mm-hmm. But if she's not around, then I try to kind of take the backseat approach to any opportunities there. If they approach themselves to hug, I kind of stay away from those.
Okay. Brian has to do a lot of relating to our radio station people here at Focus on the Family. So
I
the
do.
Many, many stations that Focus is on. So you don't just show up at a meeting and be like, can I give you a hug?
No,
just
not generally.
From
it's mostly bringing donuts or something in to lighten the mood.
Well, if someone gave me a donut, I'd let them give me a hug.
Yeah.
That's different.
That's a good right.
Yeah. Give them a hug.
That would just break barriers right there. So how about you, Nathan?
Well, I'm definitely a hugger, too. I think it stems back to your family, too. I think there's you always hear about families that were never physically affectionate. And then you hear about other families that were highly that way. And then when you bring in a girlfriend, boyfriend, a spouse, suddenly they're introduced into a whole new realm. But I definitely came from a physically affectionate family. And I also make sure I send out digital hugs when I email people, you know, an asterisk, you know, asterisk
Those
hug.
Those are more
asterisk.
Appropriate than most.
Oh.
Yeah, but no, I'm kidding. I don't do that. Usually a smiley face, though, some type of emoticon to make sure they get the point that I'm joking around. But I will initiate. I think it depends, like Brian said, on who, how well I know them. Mm-hmm. And also it depends on what's the situation I'm approaching. Am I coming to a funeral? Am I coming to someone who's hurting in some way? Haven't seen him in a long time? Those things are all factors too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think for me growing up, we weren't very huggy, which is kind of funny because I felt like we all loved one another and would mm-hmm. would consider ourselves affectionate, but it just, we never did it. I guess maybe we were just always around one another, so it's like, why would you be hugging me? I don't know. We would think that you just should do it in greeting or saying farewell or something. But it was funny because when my sister started dating her now husband, his family is extremely affectionate. So we had that dynamic, Nathan, of all right. of a sudden introducing him into our family, and he could not stop hugging us. And I'm just like, this guy keeps hugging us. And then she became more huggy, and then she tried to train our family on how to appropriately hug and how to do it more often. Uh-huh. So I remember that kind of being a discussion we had to have about, you know, let's start hugging everyone because it's so great. So it was just kind of fun.
Well, I prepared my girlfriend. She went home with me this past spring, and I prepared her to meet my parents for the first time. I said, they're going to hug you. And she was all about it. And that's exciting. So mm-hmm. I just try to give her a little bit of a warning in case she didn't come from that type of upbringing.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's different. I mean, there's definitely something I'm more comfortable with like older believers. Like we have an older pastor in our church who, when we have the greeting time at church, he always comes over and gives me a hug. And he just reminds me of like a fatherly / grandfatherly type person. But I'm not going to go up like, you know, Brian, I'm not going to come up to you at work and be like, give me a hug, Brian. You know, people that are my peers and stuff. And just, so I don't know. I mean, what do you guys have certain lines that you have of delineation of what's okay and what's not?
Well, I think generally what you said at work is like kind of, you know, stand back, you know, high five, shake hands, whatever. I mean, that's more appropriate. But, you know, outside of work, there are some close friends that I have that, we'll go ahead over to their house or whatever. Sure, give them a hug. You know, we've worked together for 4 or 5 years. I mean, it's generally very comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, what do you guys think about different types of hugs? Because I know there's always that, there's like the one-armed hug where you're kind of coming in and you just get the person's neck and that's kind of awkward. Or there's the A-frame hug or the pat-pat on the back hug that's not really an embrace. Or there's the, you know, always maligned Christian side hug mm-hmm. That everyone has made fun of. And so, I don't know. I mean, do you have like a style of hugging, or do you feel that you have to work with other people's like issues?
I think with guys, it's really tough because we have two levels. One is like the handshake, which I've never been able to do the cool handshake. And I never really know whether someone's going to do the professional strong wrist handshake mm-hmm. or the kind of like cool dude-to-dude handshake. And I never was good at that. But then you have the hug aspect. Now, when I go home and I see friends from Indiana where I'm from, we kind of make fun of it and we'll be like, man hug, and which means it's like a very mechanical embrace where we both reach out and do two pats on the back and then let go. It's kind of this unspoken like, I'm not quite comfortable doing that, but I wish I was, and I could hug you if I felt comfortable.
Or
with
you
that.
Can meld that with the handshake. There's the starting with the handshake, then you pull close and do the pat.
Kind of like this bra hug.
Correct.
So we
kind of like knuckles in your gut, and then the other arm goes around.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like if we call out the awkwardness, like let's do a bra hug, you know, then it's like it's not the same embarrassment, and it's still an intimate moment for two guys. Like it's like all right, we're still kind of brotherly, and because we called it out, and it's not awkward because we said it was awkward.
Mm-hmm. You know, but you know, you've got the different hugs like you mentioned, the two arms over the neck, over the shoulders. But then you've also got kind of the one arm up, one arm down. So as you're coming into it, you know, you got the, okay, which way are you going to go this time?
Yeah, that's very true.
I found like I'm taller than a lot of girls, and it's just weird of, I mean, even a side hug of who's on top, who's underneath. I mean, like, then it gets all messed up. And
that's
just
so
awkward.
True as well. Yep.
Well, in the Christian side hug, I'm kind of ignorant into what it's supposed to entail, because I know what it looks like, and I hadn't heard the term till I came to Focus. But I mean, is it more of a avoiding physical lust from a front hug style, or what?
I think it's supposed to. I don't know. Okay. But again, it's always awkward because you never know whose arm is going where. Mm-hmm. And inevitably you get someone that goes up or down, and then you get like hit in the neck, or you get some kind of, or then they try to like do the A-frame and the side hug. So it's just a one arm, and then you're like leaning in, and it's just like entangling.
Yeah. There's one thing though that I can't stand. If I'm going to go give someone a hug, I'm going to give them a hug. I don't want them to kind of come back and give me that little one arm thing, mm-hmm. you know, where they keep one arm down and one arm around. I'll never hug them again. I'm like, mm-hmm. nah, you're not. You don't want to.
That's why sometimes I just say I'm going to give you a hug. Mm-hmm. I just prep them. And I'm like, okay, I'm giving you a hug. And then I just kind of go in for it so that they're not wondering what's happening. Because maybe I don't come across very huggy, so they're really surprised when I try to hug them.
Sure, and just to interject a little story here, I actually got in trouble for hugging here at Focus. I was working in a different department, and the girl I was working with hadn't seen her for a little while, so I just kind of, hey, what's going on? Gave her a quick hug. She gave me a hug back. Well, our supervisor happened to see that, and we both got pulled aside separately and said, probably not the best idea to do that here. So
okay. Well, see, that brings up a good question, because what is that like? Like, for guy, I mean, BK, you are married, mm-hmm. and Nathan, you're seriously dating mm-hmm. right now. Mm-hmm. And what, I mean, is that weird? I mean, if a guy who, like, if one or the other of you, you know, if Nathan goes after your wife and is just, like, giving her a hug, I mean, is that normal or what?
No, that's not normal. I think a good example would be if I'm introducing my girlfriend to a guy I know, and maybe his girlfriend, his wife, there's nothing at all wrong with that. If it's a first time she's meeting a guy, handshake is expected, I guess. I really don't think about it. If you were to go in and hug her, because I know who she is to me, and I know her character, and I know his character. So, but if I don't know the guy very well, then it's inappropriate. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of the gauge I use. Mm-hmm.
The gauge I use as a married guy, again, like I said, if my wife is near me, then it's a little more appropriate, mm-hmm. you know, to give someone of the opposite gender a hug. Mm-hmm. If she's not near me or, you know, in a different group setting, then I'll shy away because, you know, I want to make sure that everything's done with the purest intention. So, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So now what about this experience? Because we were all in college once and we were all in this. I mean, now it's more difficult as you start pairing off and you get married or whatever, but what about just these like college group fests where you go and you're watching a movie at someone's house and somehow apparently there's not enough seating for everyone because everyone has to be just splayed out and laying all over one another.
Right.
So what is your take on that?
Go sit in the corner.
That's what Martha will do.
I don't know. I guess I've never really found myself in that situation mm-hmm. before. But yeah, that'd be definitely an interesting thing to come upon.
Yeah. I mean, I've definitely seen it happen or been in, you know, at church where some, and I'm like, you know, and it's always one of these group things where, you know, inevitably there's pizza or video games involved or there's going to be some kind of activity or whatever. But it's just, yeah, it's someone greets one another and either they hug and then someone just like lays out on the sofa and someone's like sitting on their legs or sitting, you know, or just sitting like on the sofa next to each other with like their arms around one another, just like the completely prolonged hug.
Or even shoulder rubs, like I've seen mm-hmm. guys and girls mm-hmm. doing that, and it's kind of like just mm-hmm. really, I don't know. That always makes me uncomfortable.
Yeah, I think that
can I mean, you'll have people, you'll have a guy sitting on a couch, you'll have a girl on either side of him with their head on his shoulder, mm-hmm. and they're both texting.
And he's to each other.
There, yeah, to each other, and he's sitting there maybe reading something, maybe watching whatever movie it is. And I think it's... Mm-hmm. I think that when they're doing that, they don't think anything of it, but mm-hmm. they don't realize just what that physical touch is doing, mm-hmm. is making them more comfortable with, maybe in a lustful way. Mm-hmm. So I think it can quickly go down another road.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. And what about just getting, taking a little turn here, because, you know, we were single once, you know, and Nathan, we just have him for, we don't know how much longer.
No.
So, but,
you can do it.
But, you know, it's kind of like some people, you know, when you talk about love languages, some people's is physical touch, but if mm-hmm. you're single, you have to like maintain all these boundaries. And so what, you know, for people that are really like, I mean, I don't want to say starved for affection, like they're just some kind of freaks or whatever, but we all want affection to some extent. And mm-hmm. how do you navigate those waters? Because you don't want to feel like you're coming on to someone or you don't, you know, you're really good friends. You don't want to be all like weird. And of course now, you know, everyone makes jokes about, you know, oh, well, are you into me and all this like same sex attraction stuff. And so how do you kind of navigate those waters or ensure that, you know, there's appropriateness there?
I don't know how to really answer that.
I don't either. I just go without it.
I mean, so sad.
It's just kind of a desert for a while because you know those things. If you're in tune with your love language and what you need, then that should also tune you into the fact that if you are receiving it inappropriately, that'll quickly turn bad. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what has always turned me away from that. I say, look, I know physical touch is my number one. I've taken the test. I'm digging Dr. Chapman's test. I know it's my number one, but a lot of people say, great, I know what that is, but they don't look at it from a perspective like, I know how powerful it is on the detrimental side. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I focus that energy, that physical energy, in another way, then I can quickly get in over my head. Mm-hmm. So in the season where I'm single and I know how physical touch is important, I try to prolong it as much as I can, mm-hmm. as long as I can. With that, while still letting someone know I'm interested in them.
I think another big part of that too is just kind of the length of the hug. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, if it's just a friend, you know, a couple seconds. But if it's someone you're into, you may embrace a little bit longer. And I think there's that fine line there that even as a married guy, you want to make sure, you know, any hugs that you give are only the quick ones. You know, save the best for your wife. Mm-hmm. And I just remember, you know, dating my wife, and she always would tell me that I was a great hugger. So that kind of made me realize that, you know what, I want to make sure I save the best hugs for her, and just kind of, if I don't mean to be mean, but kind of give the cheap ones, you know, to anyone else. So
great. Now we'll know whenever BK hugs us, we're just not getting the best. So, well, I think that's good though, because I think there are a lot of couples that go into dating, especially if affection or physical touch is their love language, where they will get too physical and almost use it as a litmus test for figuring out, okay, how much does this person love me, or are they going to, or they'll just, you know, let boundaries slide as is. So I think that's important to keep in mind. But I think also you can keep in mind that physical touch is sometimes just putting your hand on someone's shoulder or patting them on the back or just saying, you know, I mean, it's a good way to connect with people. And again, I think it is that kind of peer-to-peer thing that gets a little sketchy, you know, but 2-year-olds, elderly folks, you know, let's hug them, folks, because I think they need that. But good. Well, very fun. Well, thanks, everyone, for joining us in this important, pivotal discussion.
We are the experts, apparently.
You are the hugging experts, and we will close with a group hug after we finish taping, and
yes.
Then we can just decide who really is a good hugger. If BK has way oversold himself, we don't know.
Well, but we're going to get the cheap ones.
Well, anyway. I know, that's right.
No, that's true. Now I'm just all depressed about that, whatever. So, but thanks, you guys, for weighing in.
Thanks, Lisa.
Blowing in the wind, trying to stand tall when I can't help but bend. And all I'm standing on is all my good intent as I get swept away time and time again. And I know I need you now to do
Hey everyone, for this week's culture segment, I am very privileged to be in the studio with Dr. Dan Allender. Dan, welcome.
Thank you, Lisa.
Many of you folks out there know Dan, probably for a number of different reasons. He's written just a ridiculous number of books, first
ridiculous.
Of all.
Ridiculous. That is so well said.
This is what I don't understand.
You're basically a fool.
Well, I don't understand how all these people who are like counselors have time to write all these books. So either you're just literally like coming out of a session with someone and writing what happened there, or there are other, that's not feasibly, it's not possible.
I do a lot of my writing in airports, planes, trains, and automobiles. So,
right.
You know, rather than
traveling to and fro,
staring out a window, I play with words.
Okay. So apparently these folks write when... You know, I just figured you were discovering another, you know, a new thing about like the human psyche or something, but you're just writing books.
Watching so, you in airports.
Right.
That's what I'm doing.
Okay. That's good. I do that too, but I haven't written about it yet. So, Well, Dan has written, like I said, many of you have read The Wounded Heart or some of his other books, obviously Intimate Allies and The Healing Path. He's written with Larry Crabb. He used to be here in Colorado until we kicked him out, and he ended up in Seattle as the founder and once president of Mars Hill Graduate School. Also written a lot with Tremper Longman.
Yes,
so,
and the school now being called the Seattle School of Theology and Psychology.
Seattle, name change. Seattle School. Okay. So, but he is here today. I only have a few minutes with him before he's going to go fly fishing. So obviously he has his priorities straight and he'll just be done with us. But we are very privileged because he, I'm sure, has a few things to say to us as young adults. And I'm excited to hear this because you have a long, long history, Dan, of mentoring and speaking into the lives of folks, including young adults. And that's certainly the I actually went out to Seattle and visited a couple friends who attended the school there and had the chance to hear Dan teach a little bit. So and I think you just have a passion for people and for truth and for beauty. You and I were talking a little bit about this.
Plus, I have a 31-year-old daughter, mm-hmm. and I have a 27-year-old daughter and a 23-year-old son. So I'm immersed, as any parent is, in trying to figure out the world I live in.
Yeah, which is interesting because when I speak on behalf of Boundless, I find that I'm speaking to one of two audiences. I'm either talking to young adults themselves who are kind of floundering and figuring out why isn't this story working out for me in the way that I hoped it would or the way that it was promised to me, whether by the church or by Hollywood or whomever they're taking their cues from. I'll talk to that audience, or I'll talk to the parents of young adults and the influencers of young adults who are, what is wrong with my son? Why is he still living at home at 28 years old? And I can't seem to get him out of our basement, and he can't land on a career, and he can't find a wife, and he can't. So somehow there's this divide between these generations, and I want you to shed a little bit of light on this. What's the difference between, as two individuals look toward marriage or even the possibility of it, what's the difference between just being a sinner and being broken and going into marriage, understanding that, with basically being unmarriable or at a point where you are not ready for marriage because of stuff that's either unresolved or just stuff that you have gone through? Or
oh, it just drives me mad. Mm-hmm. You know, like any person's ready, mm-hmm. Or a person's not being married because they're not ready. Mm-hmm. That's so presumptive on both sides that it makes I could froth, mm-hmm. But I won't. The bottom line is, people get married who are brilliant and who are beautiful and who are not, and who are mature and who are not. So I mean, it isn't a kind of algorithm that if I put the right things in, I'll find the right person. And because we operate, because I believe in God's sovereignty. On the other hand, I think you can have a mentality the church provides, like, well, don't think about this stuff. Just trust him, do the things of God, and things will work out wonderfully. Mm-hmm. I think that's as insane as well. So again, it's not like there's a right path, but if I were single right now, I would use social media. I would use dating services. I would ask friends. But what I'd also have to wrestle with is, do I want to be married? Thinking as a single person, not as a married person, mm-hmm. losing my spouse. Mm-hmm. In that case, it'd be like, oh no, I've had one long good shot at this. And the idea of doing it again, mm-hmm. shoot me. Mm-hmm. But if I were single, I think I know that I would want to be married. I'd have to live with the fact that, I'm sorry, some people are literally called to die of pancreatic cancer. And this dear friend didn't want that, but that was his calling. Mm-hmm. How do we live well in whatever calling we have, and choosing not to get lost with the work of the accuser bringing darkness and lies to us that are just foul with regard to what our face looks like, what our body looks like, what our desirability looks like. Mm-hmm. Because at the Seattle School, we have a lot of single women. We've got really gifted people. And their common complaint is this: it feels like I've got to dumb down, mm-hmm. To hide, to make a man comfortable that he's not getting too gifted and the challenge will not be too great. Mm-hmm. And I think my response, though it's pretty easy for me to say this, is, oh, I beg of you, you know, don't. Marriage isn't worth it. Mm-hmm. To be able to hide your soul and your mind and your body if that's the requirement. On the other hand, call men to be more. Mm-hmm. In every regard, call men to be more. So the slackers, the living in the basement, it isn't a matter of just being confrontational. It's a matter of saying you cannot be a man participating in the joy that you have available to you unless you're moving into initiating countless areas, not just relationally toward marriage, but many areas that I don't see you doing. So I do think we live as men where the word coward is a redundancy for the word man. Mm-hmm. But that's not true of your generation. It's true in unique ways mm-hmm. of your generation. I think that's just as true in my generation, just as true for me.
Yeah. Well, I think it's so frustrating for single women, though, because they see, I mean, I think they really believe that. And of course, we're kind of balancing between what we learned from now, which is basically the be all you can be and just go out there and do, you know, do who you are, whatever. But at the same time, then we're called to a biblical femininity. And so, but in that, we're seeing practically play out experience after experience where the men are saying, well, you know, this is the way that this woman makes me feel. And it's, you know, it's kind of that men are drawn to women because of, you know, they make them feel more masculine or they make them feel more powerful or more important or more, you know, sufficient or whatever. So I don't know. It's kind of, it's difficult. So I think a lot of women are thinking one thing in their head, but then they're seeing the reality played out a different
yeah,
way.
Yeah. And then marry him. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. find out what hell means. Mm-hmm. The real core is this, at least from my understanding of Genesis 3, every man's asking this core question, am I enough? Mm-hmm. And every woman is asking the question, am I too much? And those two intersect in a lot of tragedy, in a lot of heartache and failure. It's not going to go away generationally. Mm-hmm. Your children's children are going to be wrestling with this. If we live in a fallen world at that point in time. Mm-hmm. So how will we be in conversation together where I may be requiring of you to say, oh, you are more than enough. Oh, you are so, that's a lie. I am not enough. Mm-hmm. So many women are requiring a man to be in a position to say, you'll never be alone. I'll be here for you. You'll never be alone. You aren't too much. Well, the answer is, my wife is too much mm-hmm. on so many levels. I just got a text in between what we were doing and now, and what she said to me was, she blessed me. And as soon as I started reading the first 5-6 words about her blessing from me, I didn't want to look at it, in part because I was blushing. I was alone, but in the blush, it was like she was calling me to be even more of a man that I can be for the purposes of God. And I was like, I don't want to hear that. Mm-hmm. It's sweet words. Mm-hmm. I just don't want to hear it. So ambivalence. If we could only allow that word to actually intersect our conversations, male, female. Mm-hmm. Of course, we're ambivalent about one another. Of course, we're not sure, even though we're not in eighth grade at a school dance, in some ways, we still are. How will we together say, hey, we're on a first date. Feel like you're at an eighth grade dance? Mm-hmm. I do. Mm-hmm. you know, and you're having a very uncomfortable conversation with a man on a first date. Mm-hmm. You know, what would it be like to say, can I ask you how uncomfortable you feel? Mm-hmm. Because I sure read you as uncomfortable. Now, does that make him more uncomfortable? If it does, even questions along the line of, how come? what's your life, your story? I don't want a therapist for a date. Well, mm-hmm. you got one, mm-hmm. and I ain't one. so that kind of freedom to play, to not be bound by a lot of the structures that, can I say this? Can I not say this? Mm-hmm. I'd rather come far more quickly into the forefront, and it will weed out many, but the few who will remain, those are people worth developing not just friendships with, but to see where that relationship goes.
So you are, we alluded to this earlier on, you're the parent of adult children, and one of them, I think, is married, right?
Yes.
Okay. So one married. How?
I'm sorry. What am I saying? Two are married.
Two are married,
married
now. Okay.
I married
one's
my
recently
son and
married.
Daughter-in-law this summer.
Okay. Yes. One recently married. Okay. So two, one to go. One to move towards marriage, if that is in fact what God has for them. But what has been your process in guiding them into adulthood? And did you approach this, I mean, them as kids? Did you map this out? Did you say, okay, I'm anticipating the culture to be crazy. I have a lot of hopes for them, a lot of fears for them. And how kind of have you personally navigated that process?
My primary task was to protect them from Christianity. Mm-hmm. I think I've done a fairly good job of that. I had to protect them from being the children of a leader, maybe not a very big fish, but a fish in a pond. And there were a lot of people there to devour my children mm-hmm. in one form or another. So,
and when you say protect them from Christianity, you mean just
madness,
the
craziness.
Trappings of it and the expectations of you and your kids as a result.
Okay. Right. When my daughter hands me a book and says, "So can I kiss on my first date?" Mm-hmm. And I go, "Well, how courageous is the boy you're going out with?" And she goes, "Not courageous at all. Tell me how you see that." She begins telling me stories, and I go, "So okay, if a kiss happens on this first date, it's going to be because you generated it." And because you made it very clear to him that you're available for that. So the kiss isn't the issue. Mm-hmm. It's the issue of why are you already beginning to take care of men? Mm-hmm. I happened to hear one of the first dates she got asked out on, which included my wife and I gardening while I heard the boy go, what are you doing this weekend? Mm-hmm. And she said, "I'm studying, probably hanging out with friends." "You want to go to a movie?" And I'm thinking, oh no, don't answer that for him. He hasn't asked you.
Mm-hmm. Well, at least he didn't say, "Do you want to hang out?" At least he identified a movie.
Same thing. Phrase, "You want to hang out?" the answer is what she turned to him and she said, "I'm very fond of movies. Are you asking?" And he looked at her and went, literally goes, She goes, "I will not make it easy for you." And he goes, "Well, would you go out with me to a movie?" She said, "I'd love to." Mm-hmm. All right. That's what I need to prepare my daughters for. How do you deal with cowardice in a way that is not cruel, honoring, but inviting? So we had lots of conversations about that. And mm-hmm. with my son, what does it mean to own your own cowardice and to engage with honor, with goodness, with maturing care for the other? You know, those are hard questions. Mm-hmm. And certainly when it intersects with her sexuality, mm-hmm. One of the first conversations that my daughter began after my wife and my daughter, when she was 12, went off for the beginning conversation on sexuality. The first category that Becky said was, "When we come home, you can ask your dad anything." So I'm sitting with my daughter, looking across from her, waiting for the first conversation, and she goes, So what are your views and practices of oral sex? And I'm going, shoot me. How do I become invisible so that I don't have to look at my daughter, who also is thrilled to make me uncomfortable?
Mm-hmm. And Becky didn't give you a heads up on that then, huh?
No, she had told me that I was going to be
okay.
In that, any questions available.
Oh, okay.
I just didn't expect that one.
Okay.
So all I can say is every parent's going to wrestle through all these questions. But if you have not created a context where you can talk about the issues that the children of my friends who are in fourth grade know about and actually probably 20 to 30% practice oral sex on a regular basis, mm-hmm. you're not going to have those conversations until they're 12 to 14?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, which brings me to another question. We've talked about this a little bit here on the Boundless team, is how my personal frustration with everything that we talk about with abstinence, and it's all, we've got all these teen programs in churches and in schools, and we've got purity rings, and we've got all this stuff. And I'm like, okay, well, you know, I remember hearing that when I was about 14 or 15, but now I've had about 15 years of, you know, college, post-college, living on my own. How come no one's talking about this to young adults? And we're the ones with our own homes. We're the ones with time, with availability, with no accountability in some instances. And what do you think, I mean, as far as casting a vision just for sexuality? I mean, obviously, you know, you and I were talking before just about how marriage needs to be, this protracted singleness, you know, is ridiculous, and this getting no sex between your teen years and your 30s and whatever, and we're supposed to just think that's normal. And but what would you say, you know, what a vision for that, just for where singles are with sexuality?
Well, have the conversation and don't hide behind the, you know, straw man of abstinence. Mm-hmm. Am I committed to abstinence? Of course. Let's talk about a theology of sexuality that does a little better than just say no. It didn't work for Nancy Reagan and drugs. It's not going to work for the Christian community. But the moment you do that, you already know we are now walking on the very hallowed sacred ground of powerful interest groups in Christianity, which for all those people who support abstinence, I want to turn to them and say, all right, tell us about 12. Tell us about masturbation for you at 12. 14, 16, 18. And when you were dating your wife, tell us about. Now, there are people who are perfectly pure, I suppose. But they were perfectly pure in thought. Really? They were able to pull that one off. I just want to say, every one of us struggles sexually before, during, and after. And if you think you can escape that by rings and covenants and so on and so forth, again, don't hear me poo-pooing that. I'm just saying you got to do more. I'm grateful my daughter put me on the spot, even if a portion of it was just the joy of watching her father sweat. Mm-hmm. It was like, okay, you want to talk about oral sex? Okay. Are you sure? Because I'll step into that with you, or are you just looking to make me uncomfortable? And she looked at me, and all of a sudden it dawned on her, at least at that age, it dawned on her, oh, my goodness, he's about to talk about this. And mm-hmm. and she started going, I don't want to hear. I don't want to know. I don't mm-hmm. want to know. And it's like, okay, but we're going to talk about sexuality for a lifetime. This isn't the one time we talk about this. We're going to talk about it for a lifetime and a lot of other things. Mm-hmm. So I think that freedom to go, no, you're going to struggle. Now, what will you do as you rise 25, 30, 30, and your sexuality, you know, in some ways is now at loss? How do we grieve? How do we deal with the shame? How do we talk about what does it mean to be sexual in our world? Is it only with regard to our primary, secondary sexual body parts? Is that it? Do you eat food erotically? Do you drink good drink erotically? Do you see and have conversations? Now, we haven't escaped the hard question you asked, but now at least what we're doing is saying we've got a lot bigger conversation to have. And why aren't we having it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what, Dan, just as we finish up here, another big, big question. I always love to get perspectives from folks who, you know, would be mentors to our audience, you know, personally and certainly publicly. But as you look at your own experience personally and as a counselor, as an author, just all that you've seen over the years, if you were to sit down with a couple, whether they're dating or not or considering dating, and you think of what they need to get to marriage, what really are the non-negotiables? I mean, I think we put up so many smoke screens and so many things of you have to be this, you have to know this at this point, you have to have gone through this class, you know, you have to do this premarital counseling. What is going to determine success in a marriage and get people there in a way that you personally would have confidence in that?
First category for me would be, what do you two do with shame? By being together, are you freer to step into stories and heartache where there's shame? Not that all those need to be done before you're married, but is there a growing freedom of, this is a human being who has seen some of my worst, past or present, and isn't naive about that, but also has a courage to be able to say, I have seen a hunger for redemption. I don't believe you will stay in this narrow hold of, but this is the way I am. So what I've said in that is several things. One, I've got to know you've got the courage to enter shame. I've got to know that you've got to be willing to grieve, but that you're also a man or woman of hope that really believes that redemption's true. So when that core is there, now, do you have sufficient lust for one another? And, you know, is there a kind of play of what the body brings, you know, technically called oxytocin? Is there enough oxytocin link that there's a kind of pleasure in being together that's both erotic, relational, spiritual, et cetera? I actually have interacted with a lot of couples who are mainstream good kids. And when I ask the question about how do you two deal with lust, they see it as, well, we protect ourselves by doing that, that, that. And I'm going, I'm all for that. Bless you for that. Yeah, but how's your lust for one another? Could it be a good thing? Yeah. Hmm. It's a really sweet thing. So can you deal with shame? And is there the interplay of death and resurrection? Is there sufficient lust? And then do you have the ability to fight? Hmm. Can you argue? And maybe it's a little bit too much. I'm of a Mediterranean descent, but can you yell at each other, cry, complain, and stay in it, and actually come to be humbled, to laugh, to be able to go, I don't agree with you. You don't agree with me. But we don't need to just compromise. We need to be able to go, I want to pick this one up again. There are conversations my wife and I have had for 35 years that are still, I think I'm gaining on her.
maybe.
Right. You're already well ahead. The point being, it's fun. We like arguing, and we have fun reading scripture. And when I preached recently on Pentecost, and she goes, you're not telling people in this church what you really believe. And I'm going, well, maybe I'm just being wise. And she goes, all right, so let's talk about the difference between being wise and being a coward.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
Yeah, thanks a lot, good. Pal.
Yeah.
So you got those three, sufficient lust, capacity to fight, and there's something about shame that's dissipating. Not because it's just magically going away, but because we've stepped into one another's stories well enough that I am known, and I'm not just loved, I'm liked.
Mm-hmm. Well, great thoughts, Dan Allender. Thanks so much for joining us here on The Boundless Show. We will certainly have, as you will see on our blog post, links to more info about him and certainly the books that he's written, and you can check those out and get more information. So thanks so much for joining us,
Dan. You are welcome. My pleasure. Tried to turn my head around for too long just to see.
Well, hey, everyone. We are opening up this week's inbox, and I have Joanne Condi back in the studio with me. Welcome, Joanne.
Yes, thank you. Good morning.
You have a very nice scarf on today.
Thank you. Do you like that?
I like that.
That's
I
kind
do
of
like
the cool
it.
Thing. I need someone to teach, you know, a fancy way to tie it.
Well, yeah. Sometimes that requires an advanced degree.
I think it does.
There are a lot of different options.
Yeah,
so.
I agree.
Well, good thing you have expertise in other areas, including counseling, because you are going to help us with this question today, and it's a really good one. So I think it's going to be helpful to a number of people. This is one of our listeners who says, I am in a wonderful relationship with a godly man. We're about to be engaged and have the blessing of both his and my parents. I'm wondering, is it sinful or perhaps unhealthy to visualize married life with him, which includes physical intimacy and sex? I know from Matthew 5:28 that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. So by fantasizing about married sex with my boyfriend, am I lusting, which is akin to committing adultery?
Well, Jesus certainly is crystal clear about this idea of lusting, and that is sin. Yes, we would have to agree with that part. I guess she would need to really go to the Lord individually and determine, is this a lusting that she is doing, or is it imagining what this beautiful gift that God has given them will be like when they are someday married. It's a very personal thing, but I think it's also in a dangerous territory when we begin thinking about the intimate act and arousing our passions, which we have to be very careful about. Mm-hmm. The fact that they're not engaged yet, we don't know how long this is going to be until they're actually married. And so she could be getting into some dangerous territory.
Yeah. And like I've said before here on the show that, you know, until you are married, as long as you're dating other people, I mean, you're really dating and in a relationship with someone's spouse, and you don't know that it's your spouse yet until it actually becomes your spouse. And so I think, like you said, that is some dangerous territory.
I really like what you just said, and I like to remind people that as well, that their future is in your hands, in a sense of what you're going to be doing with that person. And until they're actually married, I mean, they're not yet even engaged, mm-hmm. A lot could happen between now and then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So would you say, I mean, is this something that she just has to shut down, or how does she go about addressing this? Obviously, like you said, talk to her pastor, but it doesn't want to, you know, you certainly don't want it to become a situation where it's something that she obsesses over. Mm-hmm. I mean, like you said, there are things about sex you need to know on the front end, but
sure.
Attaching that to her boyfriend and kind of maybe spending a lot of time, as she says, fantasizing about it,
yes.
You know, is probably, you know, not a good use of her time and her energies and her passions and stuff. So where should she go from here?
Well, I'm not sure that just shutting it down works. Mm-hmm. It's that old saying, if I tell you don't think
just
about an
it.
Elephant,
yeah.
Whatever, it's not going to work. Mm-hmm. So instead, I think what would be much healthier is to say and look at what God says about this. There's some wonderful Christian resources out there. There's a particular pastor that comes to my mind. His name is Tommy Nelson. I believe he's a pastor in Austin, Texas. And he's written some wonderful material and done some great talks for singles on sexuality from the Song of Solomon. And so that would be something I think that would perhaps put this in a better context for her so that she doesn't set it down, doesn't think this is dirty, not nasty and terrible, can't think about it, but then instead she will reframe it and begin thinking about it as God would have her think about it.
Mm-hmm. And I think, too, like she says, I mean, I'm assuming here from what she says that because they've talked to both of their parents, they are anticipating marriage.
Mm-hmm.
They are planning to get
mm-hmm.
engaged. And that's why we always say at Boundless, you know, if you are convinced that God has meant you to be married to this person, then make that engagement shorter rather than longer. And you can get to marriage. And then all of this is going to be fine. You know?
I agree.
Like, unnaturally
with you.
Prolonging mm-hmm. this state is not going to help her or her boyfriend at all.
I think that's a dangerous territory to just put this off until it's more convenient. We have everything perfect and the finances and everything are in line. Well, in the meantime, we're kind of in hold. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when in that holding pattern is when we get into trouble.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Joanne. Just
thanks
great
for inviting
great
me.
Thoughts and good resource recommendation as well for those of you out there that want some more information on this. So that is it for this week's show. We want to hear from you. Write to us at editor@boundless.org so we can answer your question on a future show. And until then, as we head towards the end of the year, we hope that you're sharing the show with your friends and introducing it to new people, and that you are having a wonderful anticipation to the holiday season as well. So that is it for this week's show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.